So I've handed back the graded homework and quizzes. If you're not here, and I'm talking to those people who are listening on the recording, see me after class for homework and quizzes. Also, it will take me a little bit of time to get to know everybody's name. Some of you already know, but usually what happens is I learn the names and I learn the faces separately, and then I somehow my brain puts it together. So that usually happens about the fifth or sixth week, if we're lucky. So please be patient with me in that respect. Let me hand out the sign-in sheet. So I've written up here what we're going to talk about next, but before that, are there any questions, homework, or anything that you want to ask about? Yeah.
So when we have a separable equation, we get separated, but not a separable one. We have to do the
integrating factor.
How do you get the directional clues for that?
How do you what?
How do you know the directional clues for that? Because when it's separable, it's easy, because you know dy dt is on one side, and the rest is the function.
No, it's always easy for linear. Let's say you had y prime. Let's just do the most general case. Y prime plus p y equals q. Okay, where p and q are functions of t. Yeah. Well, just subtract p y from both sides, so you get y prime is equal to q minus p y. And now we're going to call this a function of t and y. And so that is, you can plot that in a direction field. So you put your t here and your y here. And what I would do, you know, I got a couple of questions during office hours about how much work to do on these direction fields. Well, you know, maybe just do a few. I mean, that's probably enough, just to demonstrate that you know what you're doing. And so each one of these is a t value and a y value. For example, this one is t equals 0, y equals 0. And so you plug that in, and you get y prime is equal to whatever.
Oh, so you can choose the value of y as well.
Yes. Y is, because it's a function of two variables, and your direction field depends on both t and y.
So yeah, you can get something because y is a function.
Right. In fact, for first order equations, this is linear, but it doesn't have to be linear. Right, you could have a first order equation, so y prime is equal to some f of t comma y, where this is not linear in y, but there's a t over here, or something to that effect. And so, you could have a y squared, or y cubed, or sine y, or whatever, that would not be linear, but it's the most general first order, and so all you have to do is plug those numbers into the, you know, pick your grid points, plug them into the calculator to evaluate this function or this function, and then you're going to get a slope. It could be, you know, zero, it could be positive, it could be negative, it could be big, it could be small. And then just, you know, sketch it in, right? Whatever it is, and that would be adequate. Does that answer your question?
Yes. There was some
You plug both T and Y in. And I saw a hand go up.
And did T and Y change the same value as
you? No. No, you know, like T is, so say T is 1, Y is 2. Mm-hmm. So you can, in fact, you could go anywhere in the plane. I'm only drawing this first quadrant here, but, and of course, that's tedious, right? Beyond belief to do more than a few. And so that's why I think, in fact, I said when doing these, just go ahead and use the software. I think I even showed you, there's a link in Blackboard which will take you to a GeoGebra application which will do slope fields. Yes?
Can you ask this detail?
Might. I mean, if I were to do that, I would probably ask you to do, you know, just a very small number, or make it very simple. You know, if you have like y prime is equal to t plus y, that's really easy to do, right? To both in terms of calculating and in terms of plotting. So, now I'll be honest with you, I'm probably not going to go in that direction on a test, but I could. Other questions? Yes?
I just want to clarify something on the small test we have.
Yes, the quiz?
Yes. I understand the sketch of f y versus y thing. I kind of never know. But in the book, it labeled it. Specifically says that the phase line diagram is a straight line with arrows pointing in several directions and doesn't have to
be horizontal or vertical.
Yeah, but how are you getting these? When you draw that, what is it that's guiding you in determining where the arrows are?
By plugging in values and determining whether they are positive or negative slope or positive or negative derivatives.
But isn't it just easier to look at the graph? Right? If you have, let's say we had something that looked like this, I don't have to plug values in and calculate whether it's positive or negative. I can just automatically do this.
Well, for some graphs, I would definitely agree. But obviously, there being some very complex graphs in your equation that might be simpler.
Not if you have a graph.
If you don't have a graph. I need no graphing calculator on the test. If you're just wanting running with numbers, it's...
Well, you're going to have a graphing calculator on the test.
And
I would never ask you anything that was so complicated that you couldn't come up with it. I mean, if what you're saying is the book allows you to do vertical, I guess my only complaint about that is how are you getting the arrows? And, you know, this is the phase line diagram that I showed you in class, and it's once you have the graph of f of y, then, you know, it's pretty straightforward to get the arrows. And... now I think I know where you're going. If you have it in vertical format, then you can draw the. It's easier to draw the solution curves. But I think there were bigger problems on that particular one. And if you want to, we can talk more about it. Yes.
Are you thinking about as far as representing derivatives, if whether we do the hyphen or the dot?
Prime.
The prime.
Well, so you know, some people do like a dot, and that's an old-fashioned technique, which actually is. I don't know if our book does that, but it's. This is reserved for time derivatives. Yeah. Now, you would think this is a time derivative because it's t.
Yeah.
And so technically, you could replace this with a y dot, but I think that's confusing. If you want to do it that way, that's fine, but I'm not going to do it that way. So a double dot would be a double prime with respect to time.
Yeah.
And you see that in physics a lot. But now, am I picky? The only consideration is it ambiguous or not? So do you know what you're taking the derivative with respect to? So like, for example, if you have f of t comma y, you could not possibly use a prime on this.
Okay.
Right, because this is a function of two variables, and if you put a prime there, I don't know what the derivative is with respect to. So you need to say it's a partial derivative with respect to whatever. And that's my only consideration. And also, sometimes, you know, if I'm solving a problem, I'll start out with the y prime, but then you convert it to d by dt, and then you can multiply both sides by dt. If you just have prime, you don't see a dt, and you don't know what to do. So it's not a big deal. I think you'll figure it out. What is customary in which situations? Okay. Other questions? Any questions about homework or anything? Okay. And yes.
Could you present the general formula for solutions in and out of a tank?
General formula?
Yeah.
I'd have to solve it.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have that memorized. Do you have a specific problem that you want to see? I mean, the idea of the tank problems, and we're actually going to, if I have time, we're going to do another tank problem. It'll be a little different tank problem, but it's the same kind of idea. But you know, when we get into systems of equations, you can have multiple tanks. But let's say you have, you know, there's some flow rate in, and there's some flow rate out, and you have some quantity of sludge or whatever, you know, Q of T, and you're trying to solve what's the equilibrium quantity of sludge in the tank, or salt, or whatever the thing is. And so your dQdT is equal to, and then there's a rate in and there's a rate out. So let's say R in minus R out. And if you get that right, then you have the equation. Now the problem is it's not always going to be separable, depending on how these rates are defined. But so that's why I say I'm not going to try to give you a general solution, because it really depends on how these rates are defined.
Okay. Now, one more question on that form. The rate out, I assume that the solution concentration, whatever the question is going to be a function of time, right? It's not going to be a constant, it's going to be some varying number.
Well, the quantity of sludge is a function of time.
Okay.
Now, obviously, as the stuff is draining out, it's going to be based on whatever this quantity is, which, of course, is a function of time.
So if we were solving for concentration specifically.
Now, be careful. Some people are tempted to think of Q as a concentration, but if you do it that way, it's harder to set up the equation. And I invite you to try to do it.
I tried.
Yeah, it's easier if you think of Q as a quantity of the stuff, and then you know the volume, and you can figure out the concentration by Q divided by the volume.
Okay.
And that makes the equation easier to manipulate.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, when I was much younger, I struggled with this a lot. I always thought concentration would be the easy thing to work with, but it's not. It's the absolute amount of the stuff in solution. Other questions? These are all good questions. Yes?
Number 11, C, 2.2.
Find the general solution. Okay, so if y prime plus y is equal to 5 times sine 2t, and find the general solution and determine the behavior as t goes to infinity. Okay, so how would you approach this? So integrated factor, so mu is equal to e raised to the integral of p dt, which p is 1, so integral of dt, which is t, so you get e to the t. And so you multiply both sides by e to the t, so you get e to the t y prime plus e to the t y is equal to e 5 e to the t sine 2 t. And of course this is d by dt of mu times y, which is e to the t times y, and that's equal to 5 e to the t sine 2 t. And then multiply both sides by dt and integrate, and you get e to the t times y is equal to the integral of 5 e to the t sine 2 t dt. Okay, now what do we do? Integration by parts. Now, is that your question? How to do the integration by parts?
I think that's kind of where I got lost. Is doing like the second integration by parts.
Okay, so let's. I think it's fair to do one of these. Everybody should do at least one in their life. And so.
Are there different ways to do that?
Yeah, I mean, there's. It builds character.
Is there an easier way?
Well, there's so I know a guy who teaches, there's a table method of doing it, and I've never learned the table method, because generally speaking, you don't have to, I mean, if you had like a high degree polynomial here, and you wanted to do it quickly, there's a way to do that quickly, but it's, this is not too bad, and I think it's a good exercise, so let's go ahead and do it. Let's, in general, so what I'm going to do, I don't want to keep worrying about this 2. So let's simplify this. This is equal to 5 times the integral e to the t sine 2 t dt. But what I'm going to do is, so I'm going to look at this integral e to the t sine 2 t. Actually, I was going to say, let's just get rid of the 2 t, but I can't do that without changing this guy over here. So I guess we've got to live with it. Okay, so we're going to do that problem. And it doesn't matter which one. In this case, it doesn't matter which one you let be u and which one you let be dv. You guys all know what I'm doing here? Okay, so let's let u equal e to the t and dv is sine 2 t dt, and du is e to the t dt, and v is equal to negative 1/2 cosine 2 t. Agreed? Okay, so we get, so this becomes integral of u dv, which is uv minus integral v du. So we get uv, which is negative 1/2 cosine 2t e to the t. So uv minus the integral of e to u. So negative 1/2 v, so that's cosine 2t, and then du is e to the t dt. So far so good? So let me rewrite this. So this is equal to negative 1/2 e to the t cosine 2t. And then I'm going to bring out the negative 1/2, so we get plus 1/2 integral e to the t cosine 2t dt. Right? So now, I'm going to call this I1. You talked about getting mixed up in the, you know, lost. I don't know if you use that word, but, you know. If you don't have a good bookkeeping system, you're going to get lost in the weeds. And by the way, this is a perfectly good question for an exam. So you might want to make sure you know how to do integration by parts like this. So, and then I'm going to call this I2. And notice I'm not including the one half here. So I2, and let me, I don't need all this, right? So I can erase this.
Except for there's a 5, did you take off?
Nope. Yeah, I've got to be a little careful. So let me write this over here. So e to the t y is equal to 5 times the integral of e to the t sine 2t dt. We're just kind of limited on board space here a little bit. So I'm going to erase all this and continue this over here. Actually, maybe I can do it down here. So the I2 is the integral e to the t cosine 2t dt. And we do the same thing that we did up here. So u is equal to, now does it matter whether we, how we define u and v?
Yeah.
Does it matter? I guess if we go backwards, that would not be good. Okay, so anyway, so e to the t, so du is e to the t dt, and dv is cosine 2t dt, and v is 1/2 sine 2t. And so this now is equal to uv minus integral v du, which is 1/2 e to the t sine 2t minus integral v du, which is, I'll bring the 1/2 out, and we get e to the t sine 2t dt. But, what? Yeah, this integral is I1. So, let me rewrite this. So I2 is equal to 1/2 e to the t sine 2t minus 1/2 I1. Now what are we solving for?
I1.
Let's see. So I1 is equal to what we got up there, which is negative 1/2 cosine 2t minus, or let's see, plus 1/2.
Isn't there another one?
Hold on. So this is e to the t. Negative 1/2 e to the t plus 1/2 I2. Okay. So anywhere I see an I2, I'm going to plug in this. So again, I1 is equal to negative 1/2 e to the t cosine 2t plus 1/2 times the quantity 1/2 e to the t sine 2t minus 1/2 I1. Now, if this had turned out to be a plus, we'd be, in trouble. But maybe not. So I'm going to distribute. So we get I1 is equal to negative 1 half e to the t cosine 2t plus 1 fourth e to the t sine 2t minus 1 fourth I1. And now add 1 fourth I1 to both sides. So 1 fourth I1 plus I1 is what? 5 fourths I1 is equal to this, so negative 1 half e to the t cosine 2t plus 1 fourth e to the t sine 2t. Multiply both sides by 4 fifths. So I1 is equal to 4 fifths times the quantity. I could distribute, but I'm just going to do it this way. So minus 1 half e to the t cosine 2t plus 1 fourth e to the t sine 2t. And then we need to put a 5 in front of it because of this. So therefore, e to the t, y. And now we need to put arbitrary constant too, because it's an integral. So e to the t, y is equal to, let me go ahead and distribute the 4. So we get negative 2 e to the t cosine 2t. And the 4's cancel. Plus e to the t sine 2t plus c. And multiply by e to the negative t. So we get y is equal to negative 2 cosine 2t plus sine 2t plus c e to the negative t. Is that right?
Yep.
Now, does that make sense?
I'm still...
Right,
that's
5
fourths.
So didn't that be 6 over 4?
Did I forget to do... Huh?
When
why would it be 6 over 4?
Yeah, 1 over 4.
Huh?
So you can do the negative 1 over 4 I.
1 fourth plus 4 fourths is 5 fourths.
That's 4. But isn't that times 5 though, in the original integral? This is the original integral was times 5.
Yeah,
let
me
cancel.
Oh, they already, I've already got a 5 there?
No, the
I1 is 4 fifths times this. And then I'm plugging in this, so this 5 right here.
That comes after, oh.
It comes after.
Oh, okay.
Because what I did, I1 is equal to the integral without the 5.
And then you put the 5 at the end.
Yeah. I mean, there's multiple paths through this problem. Hold on. So does that help?
Yeah.
Everything's correct? You have a question?
Yes, sir. Is there an easier way to solve this?
No. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, you got to do the integral.
If we come across something where we have to use integration of products, can we just use table method?
When I say table method, I don't mean looking it up in a table.
Yeah, no.
If you have if you know that method. If you get the right answer, I'm okay with that.
Cool.
Yes?
To add on to his comment, and this is just for the rest of us who know the table method, be very careful when you use it, because the first 3 times I used it, there's a plus and minus switch that you have to do, and it'll completely throw this for a loop if you get it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never saw the need to learn the method. I may change my mind at some point, but sometimes these so-called simple methods actually do have these kinds of subtleties that make it harder.
When it's not involving trig, it's golden, works every time. When it does involve trig, you have to be a specialist.
Yeah, I would think if you have a higher degree, like I say, a higher degree polynomial in your integrand, then you probably want to do it that way. But this going back and forth business, I think you got to be careful. Now, the remaining question on the problem was, what happens as t goes to infinity? What's the limit as t goes to infinity?
Zero.
For the whole thing?
C goes to zero.
Well, this term goes to zero.
The rest of it is up to the one.
No, it doesn't.
It oscillates.
It oscillates forever. You got a cosine 2t, and you got a sine 2t, and those things are happy oscillating no matter how big t is.
But one of them's negative.
Well, this one's negative, but they don't cancel.
Yeah.
So, now you, if you try a little bit, you can combine those into a single sinusoid, but that works fine. Okay? Yeah, I mean, don't be shy about these kinds of problems. You learn how to do this kind of integral in calculus too, and there was a reason you had to learn that. Because when you encounter an integral in a higher level course, I mean, you can choose not to do the integral, but then you won't get the answer. So, I don't know if what. How long did this take us to do? 5 minutes? 4 minutes? Not less than 4 minutes, but you know, I mean, it's not like the end of the world if you have to do one of these. That'd be good exercise for you. I'm a little old school when it comes to that. Just, I don't try to punish people with hard problems, but on the other hand, you know, the way I look at it is the people who can do this problem are going to do better than the people who can't do the problem. That's just the way the world works. Okay, other questions? Okay. If you came in and didn't sign the sign sheet, make sure you do that before you leave. So, and also, if you came in and didn't get your homework or quiz back, come see me after class, and I have them up here. Okay, so I can erase all this? Thank you, by the way, for asking the question, because
I want to say, how did you get rid of the fractions?
I distributed. So like, the 5 goes away because of this 5.
Okay.
And the 4 distributes, so 4 divided by 2 is 2, which is how I get this negative 2. And this 4 distributes to get rid of that 4.
I forgot that was a 5.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. By the way, I need practice on this stuff too. You know, if nobody ever asked me any questions ever, what happens to my skills? They get smaller and smaller and eventually I don't know anything. So, you guys, keep me honest. It's good to ask the questions. Okay. So what I want to talk about today is, I guess we're getting into section 2.4, and this week we're going to do 2.4, 2.5, and 2.6. And by the way, we're coming up on the first exam. When is that? Yeah, let's just make sure. I don't want anybody to be surprised, so let's look at the schedule. So, we're in week 3 right now, and the exam is the Thursday of the week 4, so that's next a week from this coming Thursday. Mm-hmm. And the plan is to cover everything in up to 2.7. Actually, we'll probably, so that's going to be on Tuesday. Actually, I guess we'll plan to cover everything up to 2.6.
And that way, so everything that we cover up in this week, so what's led up to this week and then including this week, and that's going to be on the exam. Yes.
Does that mean 2.7 will not be covered in the test?
It says 2.7 on the test, but that was a mistake on my part. So it'll only be up to 2.6.
Will we have homework due on the day of the exam?
Yes. So the homework that will be due a week from this Thursday is the stuff that we covered this week. So 2.4, 2.5, 2.6. And so there'll be a cover sheet, and you'll turn in the homework, and you'll take the exam. Yes.
Let's do this. This Thursday.
2.3, 2.2, 2.3. Is that right?
2.2, 2.3.
2.2, 2.3.
Okay. 2.4, 2.5, 2.6. Let's do next week.
All right. Because we haven't talked about it yet, so it's got to be due next week.
It's 2.2, 2.3, 2.4, right?
No, if you look at the schedule, let's look at the schedule. So it's everything that we covered in week two, which is 2.2 and 2.3.
Okay, that was the first homework.
No, the first homework was 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, and 2.1.
Okay.
And that's why I just handed back graded.
And then this next Thursday, you want 2.2 through 2.5.
This Thursday, I want 2.2 and 2.3.
Okay.
Next Thursday, I want 2.4, 2.5, 2.6. So every Thursday, there'll be homework due. Okay. Any other questions about the homework or the test? I'm alerting you to the test because now is a good time to start studying for it. Maybe study a little bit every day or every few days. Set aside a couple hours and just look at the old material. I say old material, you know, from week one and week two. And make sure you're caught up on the stuff that we're doing, the new stuff. And you know, I know I don't have to tell you guys this, but if you... the tests are only going to get harder. And I don't mean to frighten anybody, but test one is the easy test. Test two is harder than test one. Test three is harder than test two, and so on. So, but because I say it's the easier test, that doesn't mean it's going to be an easy test. So make sure that you study for it, and... You know, there's no surprise. You know, if you're listening to this recording, if you're not here today, you know, the test is a week from this Thursday, and you guys are all here. You're hearing this. So I actually had a student in one of my other classes come in and say he didn't know that the test was on that day. So don't make that mistake. Come in prepared. And try to do as well as you can. If you get an A on the first test, that makes it easier to get an A in the course. If you get a C or a D on the first test, it makes it really hard to get an A in the course. Okay, so 2.4, 2.5, 2.6. So 2.4 is a little bit of theory. And the I want to go through it quickly because I don't want to spend a lot of time on the theory. But on the other hand, it's important to know when a solution exists and when that solution is unique. And mathematicians worry about existence and uniqueness a lot, especially in a differential equations course, but maybe not the first time through, or the first differential equations course. We won't spend a lot of time on it. But so we're going to have two theorems. One theorem deals with linear differential equations, and one theorem deals with nonlinear differential equations. And so you will be expected on the exam to be able to, number one, identify your linear versus your nonlinear equations, and secondly, to be able to say when the solution exists or when it doesn't exist or when it's unique or not. So be able to apply these theorems. And I'll try to keep it simple, but you need to know the theorem. So This is the linear theorem. I don't think I'm going to write the whole nonlinear theorem out because it's kind of complicated, but we'll talk about it. So the and I'll refer to them as the linear theorem and the nonlinear theorem. They're basically theorem 1 and theorem 2 in this section. And let me just read this, and I've sort of paraphrased what's in the book, but this is, so given y prime plus p of t times y equals q of t, so this is a linear first order differential equation. And the initial condition y naught is equal to y of t naught. If p and q are continuous in some open interval, and open means an interval with parentheses, not with brackets. So if p and q are both continuous in some open interval around t naught, so think about, you know, your, if you have t and y here, you know, and let's say t naught is here, then you want some open interval around t naught. And we'll say that that interval is a comma b. So a here and b here. Then there is a solution through t naught, y naught. So if say t naught is here, maybe y naught is here. So you're in this plane, and you've got some solution. So at least between A and B, you've got some solution that goes through T naught, Y naught, and it is unique. In other words, you don't have multiple solutions that differ. And the domain of that solution is the interval a comma b, where a comma b is the largest interval for which p and q are continuous. Now that's the thing that's important about the linear theorem, is that not only do we know that p and q are continuous in this interval, but the solution is defined for the largest interval for which it's continuous. And that's kind of important, and we'll see that that's actually not true for the nonlinear theorem. Now, you know, just reading this through once is kind of complicated and may not be clear what it means. So let's kind of break it down. Let's do an example. So I've chosen two linear differential equations, first order linear. By the way, this theorem only applies to first order. Because this is a first-order linear equation. So, so what's p in this equation?
Three.
What's q?
Sine t.
So, what would be the largest open interval for which p and q are continuous? Now, that's kind of an abstract question.
Negative infinity to infinity?
Yeah, so negative infinity to infinity. So p of t equals 3, that's obviously a constant, and the domain of that function is all real numbers. So negative infinity to infinity. What's the domain of sine t? That's the range. What's the domain?
All real numbers.
So you plug any number in for t, and it doesn't blow up, it doesn't do weird things, it's just perfectly normal. So sine t has domain negative infinity to infinity, 3 has domain negative infinity to infinity, so the largest interval, and by the way, negative infinity to infinity is an open interval. Again, anytime you have parentheses bounding your interval, that is open. Open means that the boundary is not included. And we're not going to get into the theory of why it has to be open. It's just a statement. But you'll see why that's important. So, so do you all see that if you believe the theorem, Now, I'm not proving the theorem, but as the book points out, it's easy to prove the theorem by construction. You already know how to find the solution of this using the integrating factor. And if you look at all the steps in finding the integrating factor and using it to find the solution, basically this everything in this theorem turns out to be true. And so whatever the solution is by that method must have these properties. So by construction, you could prove this theorem. We're not going to do it, but it should be obvious that it's true. So if you do it, if you look at the book, you'll see. So what do we say then about the existence and uniqueness of the solution of this differential equation? It exists. It's unique. And the domain is, of the solution is negative infinity to positive infinity, all real numbers. Okay, so that's an easy one. And, you know, it's important to be able to look at a differential equation and say, where does the solution exist? Does it even exist? And also, it doesn't matter what the initial condition is. And let me say that again. It doesn't matter what the initial condition is, because the solution is defined everywhere. It doesn't matter if you say, well, the initial condition is here versus here. It's always going to exist, and it's always going to be unique. And that's very important. Okay. So, yes.
That means that when you work out, you're always like that value of c that shows up is always going to come out to some finite.
Well, c is an arbitrary constant. What you're guaranteed is that you're going to be able to satisfy the differential equation and the initial condition with a solution that does exist and is unique. And you know, we kind of take that for granted. Right? But there are equations that don't have a solution. Right? If I go, you know, x divided by x minus 3 is equal to 1, does that equation have a solution?
Find solution.
Some set of numbers that satisfy the equation.
Yes.
It does? Okay, let's multiply through and see what happens. So x is equal to x minus 3. So subtract x from both sides. You get 0 is equal to negative 3. No solution. Okay, so not every equation has a solution. And, you know, this is a favorite of mine on an algebra test. You know, find all solutions. Well, you know, find all solutions. If they say no solution, that's the right answer. But, okay. So, I mean, I just illustrate the contention that not all equations have solutions. So it's not a slam dunk that when you look at a differential equation, it's going to have a solution. That's not always true. And so you want to have a way of looking at it and saying, oh, yeah, this one has a solution. Or maybe the equation has a solution, but this initial condition doesn't make any sense because it can't possibly be satisfied.
That's what I was confused.
Well, you might say x cannot equal 3, and I agree with that, but x can't be anything. And that equation is still unsolvable. Okay, so let's take the more complicated differential equation. Now this is, so P of T is 4 over T squared minus 1, and Q of T is equal to E of T, or E to the T. Now, are there any constraints on the domain for e to the t?
No.
So the domain of e to the t is all real numbers. So now what we have to do is look at p of t. Because q of t seems to be okay. So what's going to happen with p of t?
It's not equal to 1.
-1. Yeah, so if you factor this, this is equal to 4 divided by t plus 1 times t minus 1. So in this case, t does not equal to negative 1 or positive 1. Okay. So, what does that tell you? I know you're brand new to this theorem, but what does this theorem tell you about this differential equation?
The largest interval is negative 1 to 1.
That's partly true. How do you know that?
Because it's got asymptotes at negative 1 and 1.
Okay, good. So let's. I completely agree. So here's negative 1, and there's a vertical asymptote, and here's positive 1. And vertical asymptote. And what about over here? What if you were over here? What would be the largest interval?
Negative infinity.
Negative infinity and negative 1. Well, why didn't you choose this one? You said negative 1 to 1. Or what about over here? This could be from 1 to infinity. Now, by the way, it has to be an open interval because you can't include 1 or negative 1. So that's the importance of the fact that it's an open interval. Let me erase this so there's no confusion here. So here's the question. Which of these intervals do we choose?
The initial condition.
Ah, okay, so... What is the initial condition? Y of 0 is equal to 12. So, what does that tell you? What's T naught?
0.
So, where's 0?
Between negative
1
and
1. So, you had the right answer, but was it a lucky guess? Or. Okay. I'll give you credit. You get a gold star. It's negative 1 to 1. But always be sure that you're looking at what is the initial condition. Because what if I said y of negative 1 is equal to 12? What if that was the initial condition?
There would be no solution.
No solution. No solution that satisfies both the differential equation and the initial condition. Because any real problem is going to have both. It's going to have a differential equation and it's going to have an initial condition. In real life, you just can't not have an initial condition. And so if this is your initial condition, somebody gives you this equation with this initial condition, you have to politely say, I'm sorry, but this doesn't have a solution. By this theorem. Because there's no open interval where P is continuous that has negative 1 in it. Because P is discontinuous at negative 1. Yes?
So if you said y is 0 equals 12, would that still be valid?
So, y of 0 is equal to 12 means that t naught is 0, and we're now operating from in here. Anywhere in here, right? If I say, what if I said y of negative 1 half is equal to 12? Would that work? Yes, because you'd be right here, and now you need an open interval that contains t naught. That's what this theorem says. Continuous in some open interval around T naught, and here A and B would be negative 1 to 1. So even it's not centered, but it doesn't have to be centered. That's not a requirement from the theorem. So anywhere, so if you have an initial condition where T naught is anything that's not negative 1 or 1, Now, if I'm over here, what if I'm at negative 2? Let's say T naught is negative 2. Then what is your interval where the solution exists and is unique?
Open interval from negative infinity to negative 1.
That's right. Open interval from negative infinity to negative 1. Because as T climbs from, you know, it'll go through negative 2, but eventually it'll start to get close to negative 1, and everything starts to break down.
So would that still be an open interval then?
It's open as long as I put a parenthesis there. So let me erase these, and if instead of, let's say here I put y of negative 2 is equal to whatever, I can call it y naught or anything, then where is the solution existing and unique? So we haven't found the solution, by the way. I mean, we could, but we haven't. But anyway, the solution is going to exist from negative infinity to what? Negative 2, and that's a parenthesis. So we're not, negative 1. That's a negative 1. And so that negative 1 is not included in the interval.
Oh, that's... Okay.
That's what we mean by an open interval.
Yeah. I got my interval.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, closed intervals when you have brackets. Or you can have a half open interval would be open on one side and closed on the other. That doesn't happen very often, but that you can see that. Okay? Cool? Any questions? Okay. So that's linear. And, you know, that's going to account for most of what we do in this course, but we do have some... We're going to see a number of nonlinear equations, special cases where we can maybe apply some techniques or whatever, but for the most part, what we're going to be doing in this course are linear. And so this is really the most important of the existence theorems. And by the way, existence and uniqueness are mutually assured, right? If you have existence, you have uniqueness. If you have uniqueness, you have existence.
In our situation where
there's a nonlinear, that's not going to be the case. Okay, so I want to erase some of this. I don't think I want to erase the theorem, but okay. Now we're going to talk about the nonlinear. I mean, the linear part is really simple. If you just understand what the words are saying, it's pretty easy to figure out. And if you understand the functions that are being used.
So we were just limited by the domain.
Well, it's, yeah, where are P and Q defined? And it's the largest interval for which both are defined. So you can think of it as the intersection of the domains, if that helps you think about it. Okay, now the nonlinear... It's spelled out in the book, and you know, I hesitate to write it down because it's kind of messy. But basically, what it says is, so let me just write nonlinear here. And so you're given an equation y prime is equal to f of say t comma y. And if I tell you that it's nonlinear, it means that it's nonlinear in the y. And so it could be y squared, it could be sine y, you know, anything that's nonlinear in y. Now we had a sine t, that's not nonlinear. It's nonlinear in the independent variable, but what we're interested in is linearity of the dependent variable. So nonlinearity here, we're assuming that it's y prime, And by the way, if it was y prime squared, then we'd have a square root over here somewhere, and that would still be a, you know, we're solving this thing for y prime, but we'd have a nonlinear function of y over here. And so I'm going to read you the theorem. It says, let the functions f and partial f with respect to y be continuous. So f and partial f with respect to y. And these are going to be continuous in some interval. Now, what's weird about this theorem, here in the linear, it says you've got the interval of existence and uniqueness is the largest interval for which P and Q are defined and continuous. Well, so first we're going to look at F, and what do we mean by F is continuous? Well, there's a lot of functions that are continuous. Like if I say y prime is equal to, t sine squared y. Okay, that's a differential equation that is nonlinear in y, and so we call it a nonlinear differential equation. But is it continuous? Is the right-hand side continuous?
Yes.
Yeah. Because t is continuous everywhere, sine squared is continuous everywhere, the product of continuous functions is continuous. So this would be continuous on the interval from negative infinity to infinity. Now what about the partial of f with respect to y? Now, this, I don't know if I want to do this particular one, not because the derivative is hard, but because I'm going to use a simpler example on this part here. But the one thing I will say is with the nonlinear, you can no longer rely on having the largest interval for which f is continuous. And in fact, let me just point this out where it is in the textbook. 2, 4. Because it's hidden. And, you know, I've said before, this book is a little spicy in the sense that it can be kind of tricky to plow through. But if you look on page 72, where it's talking about the nonlinear, if you look under remarks, and it says condition stated in theorem 2.4.2, which is the one we're talking about, and then there's a long explanation there. And then in the last sentence of that paragraph, it says, in fact, the existence of a solution, but not its uniqueness, can be established on the basis of the continuity of F alone. So, in spite of what might happen with partial f with respect to y, at least what we can say is the solution exists for this differential equation. Where does it exist? Well, it turns out it's not negative infinity to positive infinity. And in fact, there's no way to tell where it exists. So that makes life a little harder. Now, if you have, let's say you have some point here, t naught, y naught, then what we can say is that, let's say that f and partial of f with respect to y are continuous from, and I think the textbook uses the Greek letters gamma and delta here, and let's say from here to here, let me make sure that's true. Oh no, that's gamma and delta on the y-axis, sorry. So this is gamma and delta on the y-axis, and these would be
alpha and beta. Yeah, alpha and beta on the t-axis. So you think you're okay anywhere in this window, but it turns out that you're not, because it actually is only going to be defined and exist and unique in this interval from T naught minus H to T naught plus H, where H is some unknown number. Unknown, and until you find the solution, unknowable. You can't just look at the differential equation and figure out what that H is. So this is where your solution exists. We can figure out what alpha and beta are and what gamma and delta are, but we can't figure out what H is. And so, short of actually solving the differential equation, which in some cases, especially for nonlinear, that's hard to do sometimes. So, we're really restricted in what we can say about nonlinear differential equations until we solve them, and sometimes solving them is virtually impossible. So, now, can I do a problem that where I can say something definite about this? Okay. Let's see. So y prime is equal to y squared. Now we can actually solve that equation. And you might want to, just for practice at some point, you know, go ahead and solve it. But, and that will give you some clue as to where this thing is defined. And let's suppose that we have an initial condition, y of 1 is equal to 5. Okay. So, does the solution exist? And is it unique? Well, so we have two conditions. One is f has to be continuous in some open interval around your t naught. What's t naught here? T naught is equal to 1. Okay. Is f continuous around T naught? Yes. Because it's just y squared. And y squared is continuous everywhere. Okay? What about partial of f with respect to y? So f, in this case, is y squared. So partial of f with respect to y, now, I guess there are some people in here who haven't had Cal 3. Just give me a show of hands if you've not taken Calculus 3. So, about half the class. Okay. Do you guys know what we mean by a partial derivative? That if you haven't had Calculus 3, you're not expected to know what a partial derivative is. But those of you who have not had Calculus 3, do you give me a show of hands? Let me ask a different question. How many of you don't know what a partial derivative is? Okay. So, basically like 3 or 4. So, quick way of saying this is basically treating, if there was a t in here, then we would treat t as a constant. And so, what would partial of f with respect to y be? 2y. So, it's really pretty easy. What is the what? In what interval is 2y continuous?
All
real numbers. Okay. So it looks like alpha and beta are negative infinity to positive infinity. What can we say about h?
Nothing.
We don't know. Yeah, nothing. But we do know that there is some interval in which it exists and is unique. So what I can say is that, yes, y of 1 is equal to 5 is an initial condition that we can say there is a solution for this, but we just don't know what the domain of this solution is. We know that the solution exists and is unique in some small interval, but we don't. Maybe a big interval. We just don't know. We have to solve the equation and find out.
So I know how we know that it exists because f is continuous.
Both. Okay. F and partial f with respect to y.
Okay, so if the partial derivative is continuous as well, then that means that it's also continuous.
Yeah, the way this theorem reads is let the functions f and partial f with respect to y be continuous in some rectangle, which I've drawn up there, containing the point t0, y0. Then in some interval t0 minus h to t0 plus h contained in that rectangle, there is a unique solution of the initial value problem. Actually, it doesn't say that it's... it is unique. So, yeah, exists and is unique. So that's, we know that.
But if we have only f...
Then if you only have f, if partial f with respect to y is not continuous, then all you can say is that the function, that the solution exists, but that it's not unique. So I'm going to give you an example of that. Okay, so... so let's do that. Y prime is equal to y to the 3/2 power. Now, f is y to the 3/2. Is that continuous?
Yes.
Think about this a little bit. Okay, let me be specific here. So y of 1 is equal to 0.
No. Would the domain be restricted to numbers equal to or greater than 0?
Well, yeah, because what is y to the 3/2?
Y cubed.
The square root of y cubed. Now y cubed could be positive or negative depending on what y is. So you could potentially have a square root of something that's negative, in which case it would not exist. Now what about if t is 1 but y is 0, what can you say about that? Can you find, is this function continuous at y equals 0?
Yeah.
Yes, it's defined. Now, if y is negative, so is there an open interval which contains y equals 0?
Yeah.
Is there? If y were negative, what would happen? You'd be taking the square root of a negative number. Is there an open interval that contains y equals 0 for this function? No. Not for the domain. So I would say that that solution does not exist at that point. Now what about, let's look at partial of f with respect to y and also see what's going on there. So partial f with respect to y is equal to what? Well, it's 3/2 y to the 1/2, which is 3/2 square root of y. So we still have the same problem. At y equals 0.
2/3 y to the 1/2.
Huh?
Is that 2/3 y to the 1/2? Oh, no, I'm sorry, going the wrong way.
Yeah, we're differentiating. So both of these conditions tell you that you don't have an open interval that contains y equals 0. And why do I say y equals 0? Because this looks like a 1. Well, this is your t value. So this is your y naught. And so there is no rectangle which contains y naught that's an open interval that that allows you to determine that you have a solution for that equation. Now, if let's say I said y of 1 is equal to 1, do we have a solution then? Yes, we do. And we also have uniqueness, but we don't have any idea exactly how big that interval is for which this thing is defined.
Since it's y of 1, though, we can plug y of 1 and get a value out, though.
I'm sorry, what?
Like, if it's y of 1, which is t0, t0
is 1.
That's valid in the domain, though, 1.
There is no t in this function. But, you know, y is 1, and that would be valid. Here, y is 0.
That isn't.
It's right on the edge. You know, the function exists at that point. Both of these functions exist at that point, but you can't draw an open interval that contains y equals 0. You know, here's... So, if we think of this as y and f of y, so here's y equals 0, let's say, and, but if I try to go this way at all, I run into illegal territory. And so I can't do that. I can't go over here. And if I put an open interval starting at y equals 0, then y equals 0 is not even included in the interval. So, and I can't use a closed interval because it violates the theorem. So you're stuck. You don't have a solution for this case, but you do for this case. That satisfies both the differential equation and the initial condition. Okay, that's all I want to say about these theorems. You're going to have some homework problems in which you're going to be asked, does the solution exist? Is it unique? And, you know, do the best you can to interpret the theorem and apply it to the particular problem. I think in those problems you're not being asked to solve the equations. So if it's just asking you, does the solution exist and is it unique, but it doesn't ask you specifically to solve the equations, then, you know, unless you're interested, don't solve the equation. Just answer the question. Okay? Okay. Question?
On this question you just presented, there's no open interval around y1 is equal to 0. Could you say that the solution exists and is unique, or is that assuming too much?
Well, for this initial condition?
Yes.
No. The solution does not exist. And, I mean, if it doesn't exist, it's not... uniqueness doesn't even make sense as a question. First it has to exist, and then you can... answer whether it's unique or not.
Can you elaborate on why the solution doesn't exist at y is 0 to y1?
Because the theorem says that it has to, you have to be able to box this thing in a certain way. So here's your initial condition, and your f and your partial f with respect to y have to be continuous in this rectangle. Right? And what we're saying here is that the rectangle, if it existed at all, would end right here. Actually, it would be, you know, y equals 0 would go through this point horizontally. And so it doesn't. We can't have an open interval. See, that alpha and beta, that defines an open interval. gamma and delta to find an open interval. If you can't find an open interval that contains your initial condition, then you don't have existence of this, of the solution. Now, this H business makes it harder to figure out, even when this condition holds, where is the solution defined? We don't know, because we don't know what H is. But we definitely don't even get that far, because in this case, either gamma or delta, one of them is you know, it's at zero. It's at the why not, and it doesn't work.
So we're not focusing on the function y of t is equal to some function. We're focusing on, does that function exist and satisfy?
Yeah, we have no idea what the solution of the differential equation is.
Okay.
I mean, it's not hard to find, but because it's separable, you could do the integral pretty easily. In fact, that might be a good exercise, is to go through and figure out why the solution doesn't exist by finding the solution, you know. Yes?
What is H?
H is just some unknown constant.
It's a constant?
It's a constant.
Okay.
But we don't know what it is. The theorem is just telling us that there is going to be some H which has that property.
We have to solve for H.
We have no way of solving for H.
So
not without solving the differential equation.
But that does mean that the amount of space on either side of P0 is going to be the same.
Yes. That's what this is saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So can I add to what you said? This equation, right, is about y, and square root of y can never be negative. We all know that it doesn't exist.
Y can never be negative, yeah. If you have the square root of y, yes.
Yes. But my question is, when you're taking, like, y is of 1 is equal to 0, is it because...
Well, t is 1 here.
T is 1.
But here, y is 0.
Yeah,
you can, okay, so you're saying you can take the square root of 0, and that's true. The problem is you can't get an open interval around 0 that wouldn't have some negative numbers in it, right? If you, let's say, here's your y and here's 0. And let's say I put an open interval that includes 0. Well, what's going to happen? I'm going to have some negative numbers that are in that open interval. Some negative values of y. And if you have negative values of y in that open interval, it's not continuous in that interval. And you say, well, then, okay, don't go to the negative. Well, you have to. Otherwise, let's say you have an open interval that where the left side is 0. Well, then 0 is not included. Not even including your initial condition in the interval. So, of course, there's no solution. And if you go even further to the right, then you're not including 0 either. So there's no way to have an open interval that surrounds 0 that gives you a solution. Yes?
All right. So the first half, we're basically looking like for a domain. And the second one, we're looking for like a solution.
No, they're both... It's the domain of the solution. So in the linear case, this is just easier to satisfy because anywhere P and Q are continuous, the intersection of those domains, you're guaranteed to have a unique solution to the differential equation that satisfies the initial condition. With a nonlinear case, that's not the case anymore.
Okay.
By the way, I think at this point I want to. I mean, we could talk about this all the rest of the class period, and I don't know that it would help us improve our understanding very much. What I suggest is that you go home and read the book, do the problems, think about it, and then come back with questions, and then we can proceed from there. And hopefully it'll make more sense after you've had a chance to play with it a little bit. Okay? Okay, so I want to spend the rest of the time today
talking about 2.5, which is population models and autonomous systems. We've already spent quite a bit of time on this topic. I mean, maybe not a lot of time, but you're already familiar with autonomous equations. I'm going to erase this. So y prime equals r times y. What kind of equation is that? What do the solutions look like? Now, don't feel bad if it doesn't pop out at you right away, but we've done several problems that look like this.
Is r constant?
R is a constant, and let's assume that r is greater than zero.
It's linear.
It's linear. What else can you say about it?
Separable.
It's what? Separable? Okay, yeah. What else?
The solution is going to be in the form C e to some constant.
Yeah, it's an exponential. And if we're talking about population growth, what is the solution going to look like? So if this is P and this is Y, now we could draw the phase line diagram and be sure about this, but what's going to happen? Well, you're going to have some initial condition, but it's going to grow, the population or whatever we're talking about here is going to be growing exponentially. What was another application of this equation that we talked about before? Remember?
Predator-prey?
We haven't talked about predator-prey yet.
Continuous
interest. Compound interest. Continuous compounding of interest was another one that we talked about. So money in a bank, assuming that the interest rate is constant as a function of time. So population of deer in the woods or money in the bank, they all behave the same way, assuming, now here in the woods, what would be the limiting factor there? Well, if your population gets too big, what's going to happen? Yeah, they're going to start to overrun their environment and run out of food and probably... They're what? Feral?
Yeah.
Feral,
it's
deer that are not feral? I've never heard of such a thing.
I just heard a study where they had 50 mice and they gave them like all the food and water and everything was peaceful. And
they started to fight?
Once they started taking away the resources, then they started getting pretty savage.
Okay.
So,
is that what the term feral means? I don't know.
Yeah,
that's
the way I use it.
I mean, feral cats are just wild. They don't have
a bonded dog that was literally born feral. It was a 6-month-old puppy with, like, no fur. And it thought it was a possum. Like, it's literally a possum. Yeah, it's 16 years old now. It's perfectly healthy.
So you helped me grow. Okay, good. You raised it, you did a good deed. That's it.
It took 4 years to domesticate it.
Okay. I think they said that about my brother.
They still haven't managed it with me.
They have what?
They still haven't managed it with me.
They haven't made it what?
They still haven't managed it with me.
Oh, you're still feral.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I think we all have suffered from that a little bit. Okay. So, so we basically, I mean, this is all fun, but we want a better population model. I mean, people are concerned that, for example, the population of the planet Earth, humans on this planet, is growing exponentially. Well, I can tell you it's probably not. If it were, we're in trouble.
So, what we want instead is we want some model that maybe is going to grow exponentially, but then it's going to level off to some carrying capacity. And we can call this K. And is there a way that we can get that? Well, okay, so we've already seen examples of this. Let's just go ahead and assume that if it's below, let's say this is y and this is t. So if y is below zero, which isn't going to be possible for a population, but let's say it were, it would go this way. And what if y is above k, what is it going to do? It's going to go down and asymptotically approach k. So can we design an equation that looks like that? Well, I think I could write it down. Let's see. So dy dt is equal to negative r times y times 1 minus, let's say y over k. Now let's make sure this has the right behavior. By the way, I'm just going to admit to you, I have trouble memorizing these kinds of equations. I don't think there's any shame in that, or admitting that. You know, I'm not good at memorizing a bunch of equations. And so, I would never ask you to memorize a bunch of these equations. But I would expect you to be able to write them down. You're like, what's he talking about? You're not required to memorize them, but you're supposed to write them down. Well, because you should be able to design what it's supposed to look like. Right? So this is quadratic with a positive leading coefficient, and the, what are the, what do these things look like? Now, is this going to work?
Yeah.
What is this?
K.
Is this right?
Why is R negative?
R is positive. You mean why is there a negative sign here?
Yeah.
Okay, well I'm asking you, is it going to work? Yeah? How many think it's going to work? Raise your hand. You're the only one? Two people? Three? Have you no faith in my memory of equations? After I just got done saying I don't memorize equations?
Wait. Yeah, I think it's...
Yeah, what's going to happen here? You get above k, it's going to grow. It's not going to decay.
Yeah.
Okay, so something's wrong with this.
This is graph D, y, f y d t.
Well, the thing on the right is f of y. Okay, so what did I do wrong?
The negative
one. Yeah, we don't want this negative sign here. Okay. Do you see how I fixed the problem? So now what? So this negative sign means that it's a quadratic that opens down? Now does this make sense? This one does that, this one does that. Does that have the right behavior? Okay, good. So this equation has this solution. And we know that because we can draw the phase line diagram and verify it. And that we can do that because this is autonomous. If it's not autonomous, then we're out of luck. Does anybody know what this function is called?
Logistic.
Logistic. That's right. Very good. So this is the logistic. And if you solve that differential equation, you're going to get a logistic function. Some of you may have studied logistic functions in pre-calculus. At least one of our textbooks in the last few years had a chapter or a section on that. And I remember teaching it at one point. But okay, so this is probably a reasonable model of population, but it's not the best model. So this is exponential growth. This is logistic growth. Now, what is logistic growth? Well, it's exponential early on, but then it starts to level off, and it becomes asymptotic to what we call the carrying capacity. And any initial condition is going to be in this range here. You're never going to have an initial condition that's above here, nor are you ever going to have any solutions that are down here for population. It doesn't make any sense. Now, how do we know that this is exponential in this region right here?
Because the solution is
going to
be in the form of an exponential.
Well, it's in the form of a logistic, and if you look at the logistic and see how it behaves, it will look like an exponential for small values of y. But we can also see it here. If y is small, let's say it's very small compared to k, if y is small compared to k, then y over k is almost zero, and you get 1 minus something which is almost zero is 1, and so you get something which is exponential. And so for y small, so in other words, while you're still down here, you're going to have exponential growth. But as y gets bigger, then this term starts to cut into the growth rate, and that's why this levels off.
So I'm trying to say the reason why you remove the negative is because the growth can't be negative.
Well, if you put a negative sign here, then you get bizarre behavior. For example, above the carrying capacity, the population grows. And below the carrying capacity, the population declines and approaches zero. So that's not a population model that makes sense, or at least it's not consistent with the logistic. I mean, put the negative back and draw the solutions and ask yourself if those are reasonable solutions for a population model. Okay, so now I want to go a little further and I'll do one more, and we'll finish this up on Thursday. So,
still on 2.5?
We're still on 2.5. So if I have this equation, y prime is equal to negative r y times 1 minus y over t times 1 minus y over k. And let's say that t is greater than or equal. So t and k are greater than zero, and k is greater than t. So let's do the phase line first. So y equals 0 is going to be one place. What's another? So y equals 0 is the equilibrium. What's another equilibrium?
T.
And t is less than k, so we'll put t here. So that's the equilibrium. And then k is out here somewhere. And what polynomial is this? Cubic? And it has a positive or negative leading coefficient? Negative. So it's going to start here. It's going to go through. It's going to go up this way. It's going to go down that way. So that's your cubic polynomial with a negative leading coefficient. And so this is going to increase here. It's going to decrease here. It's going to increase here. It's going to decrease here. Now, after all the solutions, and so you got a T here, and you got a K here. Now, above K is going to decay to our K. Above T is going to grow to K, but it's let's see, below T is going to decay to zero. Now, actually, this is going to be, it's going to do that. And actually, if we get serious about this, it's going to do that. Now, K here is the carrying capacity of our population. On planet Earth, for humans, we don't really know what the carrying capacity is because that's controversial and depends on technology. Some people say we've already surpassed the carrying capacity. Other people say, nah, the carrying capacity is 15 billion or more. You know, it just depends on who you talk to. But, so this is the carrying capacity. What is this T?
That's the minimum population required to maintain.
Yes, very good. It's the threshold population. Now, why would you have a threshold population? I would just want to leave you with this. Because we just are out of time now, but listen up just for 1 minute. There was a time in human's history, if you believe such things, where we thought that human population had gotten to the point where it was very small, maybe several thousand humans. You almost can't survive with a population that small, and if one little earthquake or hurricane or whatever could have wiped out the whole population. So you have to have a certain threshold. Above that threshold, we would grow. Below the threshold, we'd decay to zero. That's the idea behind the threshold. So I leave you with that. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about this a little bit more on Thursday, and then we'll get into 2.6. Be ready to turn in your homework, the 2.2 and 2.3. And if you didn't get your homework from last time or quiz or whatever, see me now.
I need my quiz.
Okay.